calling everybody, please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 55220, Buzz Food LLC versus City of Naples, Vegas. Mr. Levin, for the appellant, Casey Merrick, for the sheriff, for the other appellant.
Chief Justice, Chair, and members of the court, clerk of the court. My name is James D. Levin. I'm with the Law School of Criminal Waters, representing the appellant Buzz Food, who offered the landowner in this case. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve my final 5 minutes for the rebuttal.
This is a 1 hour
The first issue I'd like to address that was set forth in the briefs is whether the lower court erred when it denied the landowner's request to convert this case to a taking. And because the facts in these taking actions were so critical, I'd like to talk just briefly about what happened below in the facts we learned. As you recall, in the first Buzz Food decision, which this court decided, which I'll refer to as the Buzz Food 1-1 decision, in that case, this court held that there was not a taking. But that case was decided on a 12b-5 motion. It was an appeal from a 12b-5 motion, so there were limited facts that the court had. The principal facts that the court knew is that the city of North Las Vegas had contacted the landowner and told him that the front 1 acre of his property will be taken for the Centennial Parkway Channel East project. The second important fact that you had before you was that the city had indeed adopted a resolution of mean necessity to condemn that front 1 acre. But during oral argument, you were unequivocally told that that project never went forward, that the project was abandoned. So those were the limited facts you had before you in the Buzz Food 1 appeal. Okay. On remand, we learned four important facts which are critical to the determination of the taking in the case. First, we learned that the project was never abandoned, that it was always going forward, and in fact, the project was built on the exact same 1 acre that the city originally designated for the construction of the drainage channel. The second important fact that we learned upon remand is this, that the city had purchased all of the properties to the west and all of the properties to the east of this landowner's property under threat of eminent domain for that very same project. In fact, at the time the representation was made to this court that the project was never going forward, the city was had purchased all of the properties for the project, and in fact, there was one property, Mr. Gee's property, that they were in the process of negotiating the purchase for. So this project at all points in time was going forward. The third important fact that we learned on remand is that when the city appeared before the judge and the jury on remand in an effort to defeat the second issue that I'll discuss in this case, the pre-condemnation damage issue, the city repeatedly argued to the judge and the jury that during all relevant times of this owner's ownership of the property, the landowner's ownership, the city made it clear to this landowner that the drainage channel will be built on his property. They said that repeatedly to the judge and the jury below. The fourth important fact that we learned is that when our client, Buzz Stu, the landowner, sold his property on September 1, 2004, he entered into a contract, and in that contract, he retained the rights to just compensation. He retained the rights to the award in the event the property was condemned. He disclosed the drainage channel easement to the buyer. The buyer's name was Robert Lively. And he retained the rights to the property that were needed for the construction of that drainage channel. Okay? Now, I suggest this, what happened is when we came back down on remand, that contract came in as evidence. It wasn't before this court. Mr. Lively testified in his deposition that it was his intent when he bought the property that the prior landowner, Buzz Stu LLC in this case, would retain the rights to that 1 acre property. This is what he said. You didn't have that evidence in Buzz Stu 1. He said, I know there was a drainage issue along the boundary of the property, and I knew the seller wanted to retain the rights to that. That was his specific testimony below, which we didn't know about when we were up here on the first 12b-5. Remember, the first Buzz Stu 1 appeal decision, the city hadn't filed an answer. There was zero discovery in the case. And so once we discovered that, we said, well, wait a minute, this is a taking. We repeatedly asked the lower district court judge to convert the case to a taking. He refused to do so. Now, this court's review under the Sisolak case is de novo. So looking at these facts as an aggregate, which the courts have held is the duty here. So we look at all of the facts as an aggregate to determine whether they rose to the level of a taking. We submit to you that based upon this new information we have, there has been a taking. And I want to talk about two standards that there's a taking for in this case. First, the City of Sparks versus Armstrong case. In 1988, this court held that Mr. Armstrong's property was taken on September 11th, 1972, because that's the date that the City of Sparks made it clear to Mr. Armstrong that Sparks Boulevard would be constructed on his property. Now, it's important to note that Mr. Armstrong's property was vacant. It was undeveloped. The City of Sparks didn't get around to condemning Mr. Armstrong's property until 1985. It didn't even take possession of the property until May 1985. But this court held, despite that, the taking occurred on September 11th, 1972, because that's when the City of Sparks, through their actions, made it clear to Mr. Armstrong that Sparks Boulevard would be built on his property. And that's good law. Mr. Armstrong's property was vacant. It was undeveloped. And let me say one thing at this point in time. This make it clear test that we referred to in our brief applies only to vacant and undeveloped property. Because once the government goes to a landowner and says to that landowner, we will build a construction project on your property, and the property is vacant and undeveloped, he can't use it, or she can't use that property for anything. And this court recognized that rule in the Manatee decision. That's a decision where this court recognized that vacant and undeveloped property have solely two uses. It's development potential and it's investment potential. And when the government hands the landowner a summons in eminent domain, that forecloses all use of that property. We also cited to you the Alfeas decision, the federal claims court decision, the 1988 decision. That decision is critical because it makes the same distinction between vacant property and developed property. In that case, the government, I won't go through the facts, just made it clear to landowners who are within this huge forest park area that they were going to create that their property will be condemned. The court looked at the vacant property and said, well, that's a taking of vacant property. And here's the word the court used. Because once the government makes it clear to a landowner that a project will be built on his property, and that property's vacant, the use of that property is paralyzed. That's what the court held. But there were cabins that were inside that park area. The court held, wait a minute, that's not a taking of the cabin properties when the government makes it clear that property's going to be condemned. Because those landlords can still get in and out of their cabins, they can still live in their cabins, they can still enjoy their cabins, even though the government made it clear that that property will be condemned. So they drew a strong distinction between vacant property and developed property. That's a good rule. It protects landowners who own vacant land. That Sparks v. Armstrong case is a very, very good rule. If a landowner's approach to owns vacant land, and the government makes it clear that a development project will unequivocally be built on his property, he has no further use of that property. It's also a pretty high standard, actually a very high standard. It's not the government is planning to do something on the landowner's property, so it fetters out those cases where the government's merely planning a project. And it fetters out those cases where a landowner tries to sue the government, where the government's merely planning a project. The government has to make it clear to the landowner this property will be taken. It's consistent with the movement across this country. This is the majority rule. In fact, we cited you a case called Centino, where the court used that exact same verbiage that this court used in Sparks v. Armstrong. The court held, once the results of the action the authority have made it clear that the property owner is no longer able to use its property as it had before, then that rises to the level of a taking. So this make it clear test is a very, very good test. We cited to you, I think it was probably over 20 decisions across the country where a similar test has been adopted by other courts across the country, consistent with City of Sparks versus Armstrong. And here's what, Nichols and eminent domain has reviewed all those cases. And here's what Nichols held. They held that contrary to prevalent earlier views, a physical appropriation of the property is no longer needed to find a taking. It is sufficient where government action substantially deprives the landowner of the use and enjoyment of his property. So when the government engages in these actions that substantially deprive the landowner of use and enjoyment of his property, that rises to the level of a taking.
Mr. Yes. At that point, what was the evidence of the harm to the value of the property based on your fact to obtain his claim.
In this case?
Yes.
In this case, then I'm going to ask.
Under the Armstrong case.
What happened here is we all know the facts are well said. The government made it clear. The city of North Las Vegas contacted the Crown, and they made the argument below. But they made it clear that our client's property will be condemned. So what that did is it took all value of that 1 acre property from that 1 acre property that our client owned. And when our client sold that property on September 1, 2004, he had to, number one, disclose that the drainage easement was coming across the property. And keep in mind, in that disclosure, at that point in time, the city didn't just say we're going to build a challenge property. The city specifically identified by legal description exactly where that drainage channel would be constructed. The city had its construction plan, so everybody knew. Secondly, he retained the rights to just compensation for the taking of that property. And thirdly, he retained the value of that property, or that property which was needed to build the Centennial Parkway Channel East project. Our appraiser determined below that was damage to the landowner in this case was in excess of $500,000 because he had to disclose that, and if he had not disclosed that, she determined that he would have been able to get additional money for the taking of that property. So the damages, the damages, the entire loss of that 1 acre property. Just like the court
chair appraiser put it $500,000.
Excuse me?
Which your appraiser put it $500,000.
That's correct, yes, it's hard to see. Exactly as the court stated in Altheas, it paralyzed the use of the 1 acre property. Nobody's going to pay full value for a 1 acre property that the government has unequivocally stated it will build a construction project on.
What do you do with footnote 16 in the original bus to opinion, the last half of that footnote? I'm struggling with I hear your current argument, and I'm trying to understand how we overcome what the prior court held.
Well, because you didn't have the facts again. It was appeal of a 12B5 motion to dismiss. Not only did you not have that, you didn't have the contract. We didn't have Robert Lively's testimony. We didn't have any of that information at that time. And the argument really is, does the law of the case doctrine prohibit you from going back and revisiting this footnote number 16? And the answer is no. And because the law of the case doctrine is not a limit on this court's power, it's unanimously been held to be a discretionary rule, a procedural, not a substantive rule.
But it's almost the law of the mandate issue, and I recognize that this court doesn't speak in that parlance. But borrowing on the federal court, the decision in the prior case affirmed the dismissal of all these different claims and reversed and remanded only as to the pre-condemnation claims. And so it's a struggle for me to fit this into the rubric of law of the mandate where there was an affirmance of the prior order of dismissal as to the taking of claims. That's what I'm struggling with.
And I understand that. And that's a valid concern. In the suit, the same exact issue came up in the suit decision. Where this court in the suit versus County of Clark decision, the HSU decision. In that case, there was a 52-page unpublished decision by this court.
But wasn't that a change in law that occurred?
Absolutely. The federal courts unanimously recognized three exceptions to the law of case doctrine.
So, Mr. Levitt, you're suggesting the court consider expanding the exceptions that it entertained.
Well, yes, absolutely. And that's exactly what the court did in the suitcase. Because the court had not previously recognized a change in controlling law exception to the law of case doctrine prior to suit. Okay? The court had recognized that if a prior decision would result in manifest injustice, then we need to revisit that decision. That Justice Thompson at that time said, listen, we can't gain any comfort in the fact that our decision is final if we know that it was incorrect. And I'm not saying it was incorrect. What I'm saying is we didn't have all the facts at that time, and now with the facts that we know, there is a taking. Remember, the courts also recognized several other exceptions. The United States Supreme Court said, listen, we can revisit a decision under any circumstances to meet the ends of justice. It says we can revisit a decision where there's new facts. These are widely recognized. These are unanimously recognized exceptions to the law of the case doctrine. Under any circumstances is what the United States Supreme Court said. Where there's new facts, where there is a prior erroneous decision and it would result in a manifest injustice to allow that decision to stand. What could be more unjust than allow the BuzzFeed One decision to stand when we didn't have all the facts before us, but now that we do have the facts, we know that there's been a taking? Can we find any comfort in saying, hey, the law of the case doctrine should apply here, even though we know there's been a taking now, even though the facts establish a taking? Now, in the Meredith decision, this court also recognized, it's important, that procedural rules should never trump the landowner's substantive right to just compensation. The law of the case doctrine has always been recognized as a procedural rule. And this court, especially since it was the court in the first BuzzFeed One decision, can go back and revisit that decision. I don't think you need to revisit. I think all you have to do is say, under the facts of BuzzFeed One, there was not a taking. Now, in BuzzFeed Two, we've received new facts and there is a taking.
But the BuzzFeed standard is so deferential and generous in terms of the 12b-5 setting in which it arises. The court held that it was impossible as a matter of law for there to be a taking claim on the facts alleged, and it turned to the fact that the property had been sold. The question I have is, would not your argument have been available on a petition for rehearing or a motion to call the remitter or something to disturb that before we went back and did the whole trial and then come back up on appeal?
It's a clash
between you're saying
there's
a righteous claim and we're saying there's some finality to the disposition.
I understand. The issue, the problem with that is, in all these eminent domain cases, of course, have always said, we're not going to send these up on piecemeal litigation. You need to go down and find all your facts and then bring it up. We don't get one piece of fact, then come up to the court. They get another piece of fact, then come up to the court. We need to get it all at one time. Secondly, we didn't receive this information until we were pretty far into litigation when Mr. Lively's deposition was taken. So what if we just said, hey, here's our contract, let's bring it back up. We didn't sell all of it, but we didn't have Mr. Lively's deposition. So it was critical for us to get all of the facts first. And keep in mind, we were told, just like you were, this project never went forward. Okay, that's what we were all told. When we got back on remand, it was like we were peeling back these facts. Justice Pickering, we're peeling back these facts, and all of a sudden we're realizing, wait a minute, that wasn't true. We received the negotiator's diary, where they were negotiating for the purchase of property at the very time they told this court this project wasn't going forward. So as we started to peel these facts back, we said, wait a minute, we're getting to the point of taking here. And so once we got there, which was shortly before trial, we began asking the lower district court to convert this case to a taking. Once we got all the facts, it would have been probably worse if we'd have said, hey, here's our contract, and we didn't have Mr. Lively's deposition, where he testified that it was his intent that BuzzFeed would retain that one acre property. So it's critical that we got all the facts before we brought this back to you. And that's why we're here today. I want to address one other issue.
Before you go on, Mr. Levitt, could you identify specifically those discovered facts that we think involve substantial new evidence exception to the law of the case rule?
Well, the first important fact is that the city itself argued repeatedly to the judge and jury that if the city had made it clear to this landowner that his property will be taken for the construction of the Centennial Park Bay Challenge project. Once again, I'll talk about why they did that in just a moment. That was critical. That was a critical fact. The second critical fact was that we learned that the buyer of this property intended for BuzzFeed LLC to retain the rights to the 1 acre property. So we have an intent between the seller and the buyer now. Okay? The third important fact is that the city project is built on property for which BuzzFeed LLC retained the rights to. When we learned that, we said, well, wait a minute, we need to file a motion to meet with the judge say there's been a physical appropriation of the property. The project is built today. On the 1 acre property, the city has yet to pay a dime for that property. Not pay anybody. And the city, the other critically important fact is the city purchased under federal eminent domain every single property to the east and every single property to the west of this landowner's property. So under just a general standard,
the dates of those purchases were approximately
Between 2002-2003 timeframe to 2006. The final purchase occurred near the end of 2007, which was the Mr. Yee's property. And that's in the negotiator's diary, which is in the record on the field.
And were the funds for those purchases supplied by the same district?
Absolutely. In fact, the testimony is another important factor. I'm glad you brought that up, and we found out below is that the right-of-way funds for the purchase of these properties was, quote, always available. That was testimony by Tom Brady, one of the city of North Las Vegas, who was always available. Once again, an important critical factor we learned upon remand. Now, I only have, is this the time, 10 minutes, my total time?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so I got to spend 5 minutes before that.
All right.
Thank you, Jesse. So I want, before I finish my argument, I want to now kick over to the side of the pre-combination damage. And our argument there is that the court erred in pre-combination damage.
Hey, Mr. Levin, maybe I help you focus on that issue. Yeah. Assuming we agree with you on that, there was error. Tell us how it affected your client's substantial rights.
Absolutely. I'm going to talk about the principal error in the interest of time. The principal error that was made is the lower district court judge repeatedly, with our repeated objections, allowed the city of North Las Vegas to argue to this jury that our client, during his ownership, was required as a matter of law to build the city's channel on his property and pay the $1 million cost to build that channel on his property. And here's how the argument went. The city said that they had a design manual for their drainage channel, and they had a map on their wall, on one of their city employees' wall. And at some point in time in the past, the employees at the city had gotten together and drawn a line through the front 1 acre of our client's property and labeled that line drainage easement or drainage channel. And because they had that on in their design manual and on their map, they could require our client as a matter of law to build that channel through his property. That was the testimony. That is a complete derogation of the just compensation clause of the United States Constitution and the Nevada State Constitution. The argument was essentially if a landowner owns property the city wants to build a channel through, all the city has to do is go update its design manual, update its map on its wall, draw a line through that landowner's property. Let's say it's a 1,000-acre ranch in the middle of Nevada, and draw a line through that landowner's property, take that design manual to the landowner, their map, and say, you now have to build our channel through your property. And by the way, you're not going to get paid for the taking of your property. And secondly, you have to pay the entire cost of building the channel through your property. That's exactly the argument that was permitted below. Now, that went directly to the element of improper conduct under pre-condemnation damages we were required to prove under the BUS-C1 decision. This was the argument. How could the city have possibly acted improperly in this case, members of the jury, when this, by announcing that the city was going to condemn this land and build a channel on it, because the landowner was required as a matter of law to build this channel on his property at the cost of $1 million. That's how it affected our case, Justice Gibbons. And that was probably the most pervasive error. That was the city's entire theory. So how could they have acted improperly? They were conferring a $1 million benefit on us by giving us the privilege of building their channel on our property. And that's exactly what the jury heard. And we could not rebut it. Here's why. Because the judge, lower court judge, said we couldn't utter the words just compensation. Despite in BUS-C1, this court having held we were entitled to seek just compensation, requiring that decision in our favor, lower district court judge said we couldn't utter the words just compensation. Well, there was an exception if we got permission from the city to do so. That was his order. The judge also held that all of our just compensation jury instructions were excluded. We even tried to introduce a Dolan versus City of Hybrid jury instruction. We don't know what that city says. It is unconstitutional for the government to try and take a landowner's property through a condition imposed on his property. That's what it held. The court said you can't do indirectly what you can't do directly. You can't go and impose these type of conditions. We said, listen, judge, at a minimum, give us this Dolan versus City of Tyler instruction that puts the burden on the government to prove that there's a constitutional basis for this. Denied. So the jury was told carte blanche that the city could have taken our property and required us as a matter of law to build that channel on our property and pay $1 million for it. So for you to uphold the pre-combination damage jury verdict in this case, what you have to hold is that that argument is okay, and that the Constitution no longer applies to the city of North Las Vegas. But the Just Compensation Clause does not apply to the city, because if it wants to take property, all it has to do is update one of its maps and its design manuals and take that to a landowner and tell them they have to now build the city's project on their property. They won't get paid, and in fact, they have to pay a cost for the channel.
Could you address Justice Gilbert's question in the context of the exclusion of the act?
That was another, yes, Justice, pardon, that is another critical fact which, standing on its own, is grounds for error. If I may, I'm going to go over a minute, and I'm going to say my last 4 minutes, is the Federal Relocation Real Property Acquisition Act of 1974 has specific criteria that the government's required to follow when it acquires property. That federal act has been adopted in Nevada in its entirety under NRS 342.105. We have specific evidence that the city did not follow that criteria. We have Garth Dole, who's the former director of the Department of Transportation, and he was ready to testify that his duty as a director to read that act, interpret it, and make sure that the Nevada Department of Transportation, the largest taking agency in the state of Nevada, complied with it. He reviewed the city's acts in this case and said, comparing those acts to the federal act, there was a gross violation of the federal act. The government's actions were unreasonable, they were oppressive. He said they approached coercion in this case. The lower district court judge excluded all of that evidence. We provided an offer proof and, in fact, instructed the jury that the federal act didn't apply, not didn't apply in Nevada. He said the federal act didn't apply to the city, and directed the jury to disregard any part of the federal act and to disregard any testimony the city violated the federal act. If they
well, at the time of the evidence you're removing, the judge said there was absence of main foundation for that objection. You make an offer of proof at that point. I haven't had a chance to look at that portion.
Absolutely. Number one, Justice Hardin, we made an offer of proof with Mr. Dole's testimony. We also made an offer of proof, presented that offer of proof, filed it. We also presented an offer of proof which passes through two volumes of the record, which showed that the city of Las Vegas was federally funded, and therefore that federal act applied.
So the federal funding through the Homeland Security would have satisfied the imposition of the act.
As long as the city of North Las Vegas is receiving federal funds, they're required to follow that. And that's
any federal
funds. Any federal funds.
Okay. I was unclear about whether it was federal funding for this project or federal funding for other sources.
We did have evidence that there was federal funding through the Clark County Regional Flood District, and that made its way to the city of North Las Vegas. But even more important than that, Joe Mar always, the right-of-way agent, stated that as an employee of the city of North Las Vegas, he follows the federal act. If that was specific,
why did the judge end up giving the instruction that the judge gave? That was curious to me.
I mean, why did he?
Yeah.
Because the city asked for it.
Was your clarifying instruction given? I couldn't quite.
No, he simply said the federal act does not apply to the city and you should disregard any violation of the federal act, which was prima facie evidence that the city acted improperly in this case. Remember the court, there were significant other errors during the pre-combination damage jury trial that are in the brief. They cumulatively permeated the entire jury trial, prevented this minor from receiving a fair trial. If the court would like, I'll address costs. I think that's a very simple issue. The contribution for his costs against the landowner, so the $58,000 cost against the landowner in this case was improper. The Constitution says costs shall not be awarded against any landowner in any eminent domain case. Pre-condemnation damages have been termed and listed as eminent domain cases by not one, not two, but every single court which considered pre-condemnation damages. So they were improper in this case. Members of the court, we ask that you first find that the review then over the facts in this case, find that there was a taking and remand this case for the sole determination of just compensation, and secondly, reverse the pre-condemnation damage jury trial. And I'm going to save my last minute of time that I have for this. If I may, thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Stacey Harris, and I represent the City of As we all know, this is the second appeal in this case, and in the first issue, in the first appeal, this court addressed whether or not the district court properly dismissed claims that they brought for inverse condemnation and pre-condemnation damages alone. Now, deciding the district court had properly dismissed all those claims other than pre-condemnation damages, this court held that there was no taking. And that was a very high standard. This was from a motion to dismiss. This court decided that it was beyond a doubt that Webstu could allege no facts to show that the city had taken property here. And that's an important point here because the court was looking at everything Webstu had alleged. And the remand back to the district court was very narrow. It said the district court was to conduct further proceedings with regard to the pre-condemnation damages claim. After a 7-day trial, the jury decided that the city had not committed any oppressive conduct. They had not engaged in any extraordinary delay. But it said that the jury found the city did nothing wrong, nor did entitle us to the damages.
Could you address your opposing colleague's argument that we should adopt a substantially different evidence, really different evidence, and B, his claim that such evidence exists in this case that would justify the reopening and require determination on the taking?
Absolutely. As the Shu decision recognized, the federal court recognized the security generally accepted exceptions to a lot of case law. And Shu only adopted in that case the new controlling evidence. Now, the city doesn't really have a position on whether or not this court should accept substantially new evidence as a new exception. It's just that this case is not the case to do it in because there wasn't substantially enough information. Now, I wrote down what they said the new facts were on the amendment, so I can address them all. First, they said, well, the project is not abandoned and it was built. Well, I want to address that for a moment. When we came up on remand in the first case, the city did not have construction plans. Those were the facts. When this was argued before this court in October 2007, the city did not have construction funding. The project wasn't going forward at that point. And that was in response to a question from Justice Douglas. He had asked, referring to the resolution condemned in this case, did this go forward? And Mr. Walsh had replied, no, it didn't go forward, meaning that the resolution had not gone forward. He also revealed to this court, both in briefing and in oral argument, Standard Pacific, or the subsequent owner, did dedicate that easement to the city. That was not a hidden fact. I think that may have been something they said was a new fact. It wasn't. We knew that in the first appeal. It also had really nothing to do with the city's decision or the court's decision.
Is there a difference between the power to acquire the property and the power to build the property?
There was a funding difference here, and the evidence below showed that there was two separate funding from the flood control district. One, they were given acquisition funds, and once they had those, they started negotiations with the property owners. But the construction funding was a separate application that had to be made to the flood control district. When they started the process of negotiating and acquiring these, they learned from the flood control district that your project is in back burner. You're not getting these construction funds. We're not sure when you're getting these construction funds. Yes. They had.
From one standpoint, that's the issue of the court's concern.
Well, the city never said they didn't have funds to acquire. The reason they didn't go forward with an eminent domain action is not having construction funds and not knowing when construction funds may become available. Presents an issue because when you take property.
Are they inaccurate in terms of representation? Are you still negotiating with other landowners who are similarly situated?
There was no question. I don't believe that at any time during the first appeal there was an issue or questions about whether or not other properties were being negotiated and acquired.
Council, what I'm asking for is candor from the council for that specific question. Mr. Leatherwood asserts the facts were otherwise. I mean, for you to give me an idea of what actually was going on.
There always was acquisition funding. And that the city's never been less, he's always been had candor about that. They never had construction funding up until, I believe, right around the time of those two decisions came out, March, April 2008, they finally did obtain construction funding for the project. At the time of oral argument, briefing, everything in those two ones, there was no funding for construction. And my point was that although there was funds for acquisition, when a government goes forward and takes property, there's a time limit from when you take that property to when you have to actually build a project. So not having construction funding, that makes the government nervous to go ahead and use eminent domain to take property when they don't know when or if they can build at that point. But they did go forward with negotiation because those were voluntary ownership for the property. It wasn't a taking in the sense of when that time limit kind of comes into play there.
Ms. Hera, Mr. Levitt's point is that those acquisitions were under threat of eminent domain by those property owners. Is that right?
I guess what he means by threat of eminent domain is someday we're going to build this channel and we'd like to buy a season from them. You can say no, but if we're trying to negotiate with you, well, certainly. It was under threat of eminent domain that, yes, the city had eminent domain powers.
I'd like to ask you about the statement Mr. Walsh made in response to Justice Douglas' question in October of 2007. In response to Justice Douglas' question about whether the project, and this is Justice Douglas' words, had been abandoned, Mr. Walsh said, the city did not proceed with this project for reasons that are not of record, but it made the election to not go forward with the project. Now, maybe there was a misuse of words, or perhaps an overstatement, but my understanding of the record is that there is no vote or election by the city to abandon the project, as these words would imply.
Right, and I think Your Honor is correct that perhaps the words used were not entirely accurate. You're in an exchange in oral argument, sometimes what comes out of your mouth is not entirely the same. I've discussed this point with Mr. Walsh, and that's also not a record in this case, but I had to understand what happened. When he took that question from Justice Douglas, he understood Justice Douglas to mean the resolution, this resolution to then go forward. No, that was no one. But he also was saying the project couldn't go forward because as of October 2007, there was no funding yet constructing it.
The interesting legal question that I'd like to ask you about then is whether the court should, you've indicated that the city has no position about whether this court should extend its jurisprudence on exceptions to the law of the case under substantial new evidence. Your contention is there is no new substantial evidence to form the basis for that exception. But that said, perhaps there is, under the Armstrong decision, could you comment on the applicability of the Armstrong decision in that context?
Certainly, I'd love to talk about that. Number one, I think we need to be clear before I discuss that, because there's some conflation of the evidence here. Let's use the law on the property in July 2004. September 2014 is when the deed recorded, so it was in that time frame. And it really did sell all of its property. The deed made no reservations of any of the 20 acres. The purchase and sale agreement, which by the way, Bustu had its possession at all times during Bustu 1, if you believed he had to held the property interest, he certainly would have made it known to this court at some point. Instead, the allegations in the complaint were that Bustu sold all of its property and it only received reserve rights to condemnation proceeds should condemnation actually be filed. And if you look at the plain language of the purchase and sale agreement, that holds up. It wasn't only until remand that Bustu changed his position and said, oh, no, no, we reserved the easement. Well, if you had reserved the easement, I certainly think you would have tried to make it known to this court the first time around. Now, talking more specifically about Armstrong, that's exactly the same claim that this court rejected in Bustu 1. This court said that the announcement to condemn does not rise to a level of taking by itself. But they just argued that it does. They said the announcement destroyed the entire value of the property. Well, the evidence of this case is It's exactly opposite. Webster had absolutely no problem selling his property, and it sold his property for its list price. There was no reduction in value. They said, we want $8.2 million, and guess what? Mr. Levitt said, I will pay you $8.2 million for that property.
Mr. Levitt has indicated that their appraiser indicated that there was a $500,000 reduction in value created by this specter of this condemnation. Is that correct?
We need to look exactly what their appraiser did. What their appraiser did is look at the easement and the resolution and value that easement. She didn't look at whether or not Celestia sold his property for a lesser value. She didn't compare what the market value of the property was to how much they sold it by the city's appraisal date. She just looked at that 1 acre and said, that 1 acre is worth $500,000. Well, Celestia sold that 1 acre in that $8.2 million. So the appropriate way to look at the valuation here is to see if that announcement reduced the value of Celestia's property. Because we're talking, we also have to understand, we were trying to keep condemnation damages claim low. There was no kidding in being tried. So the value of the easement as if it was taken was kind of an improper thing for the appraiser and to say it was worth $500,000. He sold it for less than $500,000 because if they had taken it, it would have been worth $500,000. It's kind of what she did. But that wasn't the claim being tried. I'd also like to quickly address the Armstrong made it clear standard. What Armstrong actually said, where it says make it clear in that decision, it said Sparks made it clear that it would not allow development on that property. And that's the difference here. The city of Sparks was actually interfering with Armstrong's use of the property, and that's where the taking came from. Here the city did nothing to interfere with us to do. Those who sold the property very easily for its list price. And Bosu never had any intention of developing that property and made no efforts to, and the city certainly didn't interfere with any efforts to. That was the evidence below by Bosu's representative that this was, they were simply investors. They had no interest in developing this property. And after Bosu sold the property, guess what? Santa Pacific did develop it. There was simply no interference with their use of this property. And I do want to quickly address, too, I think it was Justice Kipling that asked about the mandate that was sent down to the district court. Under the Lager case, the district court could not have erred for refusing to transform this into a takings offense. Under this court's precedent in Wickliffe v. Sunrise Hospital, this court has said, a district court that fails to follow a mandate from this court to the letter, anything that district court did is null and void. The mandate from this court was there is no taking, here to conduct further proceedings on a pre-condemnation damages claim. The district court did not have discretion to transform this case into something else. Whether or not this court wants to look at that issue again here is another issue entirely. The district court simply could not have erred from refusing to ignore what this court would do. I also want to address, now they also said there was other substantial evidence in the room. First of all, I think I addressed this, but I just want to touch on it briefly again. They said on remand they discovered the purchase and sale agreement reserved an easement to them. I simply don't understand that argument. They were in full possession of their own purchase and sale agreement from the moment they sold the property. Certainly their own client knew whether or not he intended to reserve an easement. They did not need testimony from Mr. Wright in saying such. And frankly, I didn't review Mr. Wright's deposition before this, but it's my recollection he didn't say that. He said it was something more along the lines of it was his intent to have the eminent domains back. He didn't really care whether or not that he reserved eminent domain proceeds because generally you have to dedicate great engagement when he developed anyway. It was of no consequence. Now, the actual purchase and sale agreement did not reserve an easement to us, too. The reservation was to retain all rights and proceeds arising out of any condemnation proceeding relating thereto. And that's what the Westview told this court in its complaint and in clause 2-1 that the sold property only reserving rights to any domain person. So there's nothing new discovered on the land. There's just only a change in position that that's good.
Sarah, I hate to repeat this question. I know you kind of covered it earlier, but I'd like to repeat it. It seems to me it's important for the new evidence question. You're acknowledging that there were property acquisitions going on in 2003, 2004, 2005, at the same time that the city was claiming that it was no longer going to pursue this condemnation of this property. But the distinction you're trying to make is we had acquisition funds, we didn't have construction funds. Is that the distinction? Why wouldn't their learning of the acquisitions that were taking place at other properties constitute significant evidence to yield for the table of this question?
Well, I think primarily because it's irrelevant. Just sold all of the property in 2004. It no longer had a property interest. Whether or not the city was negotiating with other landowners for this project to build something in the future, not really knowing that.
Well, I'd like to explore that argument with you a little bit. We assess takings claims based on the time of the taking. In this case, the taking it would be alleged would have occurred in or before the sale. So why wouldn't the takings have occurred before the sale? So the sale wouldn't make any difference. It wouldn't nullify the fact of the takings.
The sale would, if there was a taking, and again, the taking they're claiming is the exact same taking as raising those to one. That resolution of them by itself was a taking of property. That was for the rest of us.
What they're saying is they didn't know they were acquiring the properties. They didn't know the the project, that this court was operating at least under the assumption that he'd abandoned it. None of which now appears to have been the case.
I apologize for having a little bit of a difficult question. You look at whether there's a taking at the time of whatever actions you say was the taking. So I don't understand how actions that then occurred 3 years later in 2007 with regard to other property owners can transform conduct in 2004 to be a taking when in 2004 it was not a taking. And I guess that's my answer, is that you have to look at what was actually happening in 2004 or 2003, I think, is when the resolution was. And you have to look at it at that point, was that a taking? If subsequent actions were to cause a taking, then those subsequent actions at that time would be. If they did something, the city did something in 2007, that some rose to the level of taking, well, the taking would occur in 2007. That 2007 conduct wouldn't transform the 2004 conduct into a taking.
I guess the answer what your opponents would offer is that you never really abandoned the taking intention.
Again, they did abandon the idea.
All this subsequent conduct
right.
Demonstrates that you never really abandoned, as you suggested.
Well, the city, and in West 2-1, they never said that, and the facts of the case were the resolution passed in 2003. They sold their property in 2004. During that year, the city didn't do anything. They didn't even talk to the property owner, I believe it was evidence, but it said maybe once. Saying we have filed or something like that.
I guess your best argument would be that prior to the time they sold the property, the basis for taking it around strong didn't occur.
And I think that's correct. And frankly, I don't think the basis for taking it around strong ever did occur.
While they owned it
at the very least. But certainly, Armstrong requires more than just an announcement. It requires to actually interfere with use and enjoyment of the property to them, either by preventing you from being able to develop or telling you that we're going to take this someday so you can't ever go, which is basically what's me first. So that actually interferes with substantial use and enjoyment of the property. The city never said any such thing to Buzzfeed. The evidence again below was that Buzzfeed was able to sell, and Buzzfeed could develop a third developer. So other developers could develop the property later. And then I answered your question.
Well, you've done a remarkable job of trying to re-clarify my question as it was comprehensible in answer. I do think it would be helpful if you could be probably going to get this comment about the exclusion of the Relocation Act and the design manual evidence.
Certainly, and I'll be able to jump into those questions. I think, first of all, we need to be very clear about what the evidence was below when we're talking about this design management. This was the flood control district's design management. It's not the city's, number one. This was the flood control district's master plan. It was not the city's. The city has an ordinance that says they have to follow all master plans of other agencies, such as the flood control district. But the city was not just drawing lines around on a map and saying, haha, we can take your property now. That's not what happened. This was a flood control district master plan facility. And the flood control district manual says that flood control district has a policy that upon development, the developer has to build all master plan facilities that are on or next to the property that's going to be developed. Again, not a city policy, flood control district manual, flood control district policy. Now, the evidence below, and I want to be very clear about this, the city never argued that it couldn't have acted improperly because Lestu would have had a little channel. That argument, you will not find that in the record anywhere. That was not the city's argument. The city's argument was, and this really only went to damages. This was the whole city's point, this went to damages here. Whether or not the announcement to condemn was a negative factor on this property, thereby reducing its market value. The evidence and the argument that the city made was the market knows the flood control district has this policy of making developers build master plan facilities. The master plan facility here was an open trapezoidal channel. The city, when it announced this intention to condemn for a project, the project it announced was an underground channel, and the city would be paying for it, thereby relieving a developer of any of having to comply with that flood control district policy of building master plan facilities. And therefore, the market would see that announcement to them as more of a positive factor than a negative factor in the market value of property, because it announced to the world that a developer would be relieved of the burden to do something about the drainage channel, whether it was the builder itself or to fight it as an unconstitutional exaction. Either way, that put a burden on the developer to do something, but the city's announcement announced to the market and the world that you don't, that burden is gone now.
How can we see if that is true if later the city required the new owner to dedicate to do it themselves to pay for this channel?
Oh, they didn't. They accepted a dedication of the easement from the new owner. The city built the property.
You say they accepted a dedication, did the city require them to give this dedication?
As part of a development agreement, yes, the city asked for a dedication. The subsequent owner had no problem with it. They gave them a dedication to drainage easement.
Were they required to do this? Did they have a choice?
It was part of the development agreement. Again, that's what the city asked for. As part of the development agreement, I guess you need to dedicate the drainage
easement. So the developer agreed, I would be able to decide to spend extra $1 million to build this project.
No, the developer did not build the flood channel. The developer only gave the property. The developer did not build any of the flood channel. The city built flood channel and flood control district funds. The developer was not asked to pay for any of the flood channel. The developer did not pay for any of the flood channel. The developer simply dedicated the drainage easement on which the channel was built.
What would happen if he didn't dedicate it?
If he didn't dedicate it, he probably would have had a problem getting the development agreement. And that's understood by all developers, and I think that's understood by this court. Now, a developer can fight dedication requirements. There is an administrative way to do that. This owner chose not to. They were okay with the requirement. I do want to, because the relocation act was brought up, so this briefly. The reason the district court excluded the evidence about relocation back to Lowe's is it didn't apply to this project. And the district court came to that conclusion based on the cases of CCLAC and Albert, in which those cases said the Relocation Act only applies when there's federal agency involved or there's federal funding for the project. In fact, in Albert, because the question in Albert is whether or not the Relocation Act applies to that, the land of the claim attorneys. In Albert, the court said that the landowner had not shown that federal funds were used for the project, therefore, they're not entitled to attorney's fees under the Relocation Act. There's two things you need. You need either a federal agency involved or you need federal funding for the project. It's not simply any federal funds anywhere that the city might happen to be getting for something completely unrelated. It's whether or not the project has a federal, some sort of federal component. And that's really not unusual. You see this a lot when you apply federal statutes to state actions. There has to be some sort of federal hook in that specific project in order to make that federal statute apply. See this in the environmental realm quite often. And it's the same thing here.
So, were there federal funds provided to the district, provided to the city for acquisition?
The evidence below was from the city's attorney who dealt with the partnership on the payment of this project, that all the funds for the project came from local taxes. The flood control district may get federal funding for other projects, but this project is specifically designed to use local taxes to pay for it. And that's where the funding came from. And that was the only evidence below on that issue, and that there was the specific funds for the project actually came from.
Was there any discussion if the city of North Las Vegas was representatives or members of the regional Flood Control District in Clark County? Was that an issue or did that come up?
Whether or not that...
Yeah, the city, isn't the city or the city council members or members of the regional Flood Control District in Clark County?
That wasn't really an issue that came up for Lowe. I'm personally not really familiar with how the makers...
If it didn't come out, that's fine.
And I think my few minutes remaining, I just want to address quickly the cost issue. In this case, the jury found that the city had no liability for pre-condemnation damages. Even in the inverse condemnation case, where it's actually arguing it's making the property, other states have held when there's similar statutes and constitutional requirements that if a taking is not found, that statute saying that you can't get cost doesn't apply. That's because when there is no taking, there's no constitutional implications involved there. And so the same idea applies that we want to have, the winning party should get cost, because the cost issue is basically soft frivolous lawsuits. And so there has to be some sort of hook there. If you're just bringing cases all the time saying there's a taking when you really don't have the facts, then maybe the landowner should be responsible to pay those costs under the normal cost statutes. Because you're not getting to the point of it being a constitutional problem, because there's not been a taking. And that's where the distinction comes also. I think there was a pistol where it says a landowner shall not pay costs on the eminent domain action. Well, when you have an eminent domain action, the taking is already done. That's the city's that we are taking with the original issue. Inverse condemnation has a first hurdle. You have to put a taking first. And that's where the difference comes in whether or not costs should be applied when there's no taking found, or here where there's no liability found. And also as a secondary point, and I really didn't have the opportunity to address this, is that this case, the pre-condemnation damages claim, when there is no taking, is not an inverse condemnation case. The Nevada Constitution says there's just compensation is to be paid when there's a taking, and there it ends. There's no expansion of damages for other areas or any sort of incidental decrease in market value the city may cause by its actions, which pre-condemnation's damages in many ways are, because it is a damage completely separate from the taking. It's in addition to, it's measured in a completely different way because it occurs before the taking. And here we didn't even have a taking. So the Constitution itself is owned by it. Unless the court has any questions.
In connection with the issue about the supply of federal funds to the district, my understanding is that the record at J3609 was a document offered by a student's council to demonstrate that the district had received both state and federal funds for this project. Do you recall that document and why that was not considered by the district court?
I don't recall that document. I have to say there was some additional offers of proof just submitted to the court during the middle of trial after the ruling had already been made, and they may have been in that conflict. My understanding was that the document showed flood control district gets federal funds, not that it got federal funds for this district. That I would help
the other side. I doubt that your argument leaves, obviously, if that was the case, but that would be your response. I just wondered if you would call the document. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So, Leather, round off your level kind of 3 minutes.
Oh,
for an extra 2 minutes.
Thank you, Justice Chairman. First, I just want to address that first pre-condemnation damage issue with the argument that the government made to the jury below that our landowners required to build this project at this cost. The argument we just heard is it was merely just a policy in the government's manual. That's all we really told the jury. Quoting from page 6795 of the record on appeal, this is counsel. The owner would have to build it at the owner's cost. Quoting from page 7431 on the record on appeal, I said the city code and the language in the design manual requires it. Okay, I said the manuals and our ordinances required it. Going on. The most important thing, though, is they will both tell you, instead of the owner slash developer having to build this, referring to the channel, right? The city built this one at the city's cost for the landowner. That's why that was such critical testimony in regards to the improper conduct element, because they told the jury the city was building this for our client. That's why it's so important. They didn't just say this is some policy and the record for people in the state might recognize this is not some other benefit. But perhaps the best one, this is a quote, 6827, opening statement. Randy Cable will go to the regional flood control district now, and if there's not a facility on it, as a matter of law, the landowner would have to build that city. Once again, they didn't just say it was a policy. They told this jury over our strenuous objections that our landowner is required to build this channel. That was extraordinarily prejudicial evidence, and it violated the Constitution. It's ground, that error on its own is grounds for reversal. Now, I want to talk about the Armstrong case, because what we heard here is that Buskew sold the property, therefore he's not entitled to be paid anything. Okay, first of all, in the Armstrong case, Mr. Armstrong sold his property twice. It sold to one landowner, and he resold it to another landowner, and the government didn't file a condemnation action until 1985. The court looked at the conglomerate of all the facts, and the most important fact is the government actually built Sparks Boulevard in Armstrong, and then said, okay, when's the date of taking? Well, the date of taking is back in 1972, even though the property was sold, because that's the first time the government made it clear to Mr. Armstrong that his property will be taken for Sparks Boulevard. And that's good law, because Mr. Armstrong also had to disclose Sparks Boulevard in his sale document. And by thereby disclosing it, as the Althea's court recognized, that froze the use of that property, and he didn't get to sell it. And by the way, the 1 acre property in this case was never developed. Okay? That's never been developed. Certainly there was a development agreement, as you asked, Justice Douglas. That development agreement required that that landowner hold that property out. If I may just make one last statement to Justice Cherry, 15 seconds. The argument was also made that this evidence of us being required to build this channel was only damage evidence. The record showed that that evidence only came in through Dan Lee and Randy Cable. Neither of them testified to damages. They both testified to liability. Thank you.
Just as your last one. Mr. Levitt, you heard Ms. Hart's comments about the federal funding and all going to the, there's no federal funding related to this particular project here. Again, what's your position on that? Is there any evidence developed about federal funding and where Matterhorn was used?
Absolutely, and that was correct. Just as far as in the record, we submitted offer proof number two, which showed two things. It showed number one, that the Clark County Flood Control District was federally funded, and that that money for this was, this project was coming directly from the Clark County Flood Control District. Number two, that the city itself was federally funded. And if the city receives federal funds, the city is required to comply with the Federal Rehabilitation Act, or the Federal Act. But keep in mind, that act has been adopted in its entirety in the state of Nevada under NRS 342.105. And once again, Joe Mar always himself said, I follow the Federal Act. I'm a right-of-way from the city of North Las Vegas, and I follow it.
Okay.
So yes, there were federal funds.
Okay. Well, quick thanks, Ms. Sarah, and then I'll just run through your answer. Outstanding arguments. This chair will stand submitted. I'll be in recess.
All rise.